Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Over the past few weeks, we have been discussing Republican-sponsored voter suppression and minority rule. Today's guest, David Daley, has an important piece in the New Republic called Inside the Republican Plot for Permanent Minority Rule, how the GOP keeps cheating its way into power and may get away with it again in 2020. The piece includes damning quotes from Republicans like Bob Inglis, who calls the Republican plan to suppress the vote an apartheid system. Neoconservative Bill Kristol, a never Trumper, said, quote, "We lost faith that we could compete for votes and win elections. Therefore, you've got to start restricting the electorate, and that's very bad for democratic principles and very bad for a political party," end quote. David Daley is an independent journalist, senior fellow for Fair Vote, and author of Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, pleasure, Rose. Thanks for having me. You've been doing such great work on this topic over the last couple of weeks. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And thank you for your latest piece, David. These quotes from Republicans were just so damning.
You know, I was really thrilled and happy that these Republicans were willing to talk on the record and that they were willing to be so open. I think that if we are going to step back from the ledge, it's going to require Republicans to do so. They're the ones who put us on this ledge. So if we're going to walk back, it's going to have to be with their help. Bob Inglis, I covered Bob Inglis as a reporter in Washington in the 1990s, and he was one of those true believer conservatives who came into power with Newt Gingrich. He's a very conservative man. And when he is willing to call what his party has done an apartheid system, I think we ought to all stand up and take a little notice. It's one thing when, you know, you and I say this. I think it's another when a deeply conservative white congressman from South Carolina is willing to go on the record and talk about it.
Right. And we'll talk more about your piece in a minute. But first, I'd love to get your overall thoughts about where we are right now. It seems that people are really standing up to voter suppression and saying, you know what, we're going to vote in massive, massive numbers.
You're right. These numbers are impressive and they're exciting and inspiring. And it's wonderful to see so many Americans saying we are going to overcome all of these voter suppression efforts. We're going to make our voice heard. At the same time, I think we ought to be outraged that such superhero efforts are required to cast our vote. We are still in the middle of a pandemic, that we have a political party that is willing to go to these extremes and force Americans into these long lines. Long lines that, let's face it, are for many Americans a poll tax if you are forced to give up work or to take on additional child care. So every time I look at these long lines, I'm at once inspired and yet also completely outraged that America in 2020, in the midst of a pandemic, is making it this difficult for our people to vote, even as we are determined to get out there and make ourselves heard.
Exactly. And it's so hard to keep up with all of these rulings. We've been talking about what's going on in Wisconsin, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. And just yesterday, a federal appeals court ruled that mail-in ballots in Minnesota must be received by election officials no later than Election Day. So at this point, this is Friday, no matter where you are, if you've got an absentee ballot, either hand it in person or go in and vote in person.
That's exactly right. It is far too late at this point to be using the mails. I wouldn't have been using the mails for probably even the last 10 days. In the state of Wisconsin, it's taking 10 days for a letter to reach its destination. Simply don't have that kind of time. And what we are seeing is that in state after state, you just rattle them off: North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Wisconsin, states that are going to be close, states that were close in 2016. Republicans are going to be fighting any ballot that arrives after November 3rd, even if it is postmarked today, even if it is postmarked, you know, 5 days ago. If that ballot arrives on November 4th, it might not count. And what we are seeing is that Republicans are trying to tee up a number of cases along the lines of Bush versus Gore, this time in multiple states, that will attempt to stop the count of ballots, perhaps on election night. And what we should all be shocked and concerned by is, even as record numbers of Americans show up to vote, there is a Supreme Court in Washington that has been packed by Republican presidents who did not win the popular vote, that is making a series of deeply disturbing rulings over the course of this last week that suggest they are open to very anti-small d Democratic theories that could indeed cut off votes and perhaps throw us into the kind of constitutional crisis that it would be difficult to imagine how it ends or how we come back from it.
Well, it's just very important to emphasize, if you are in a battleground state or if you have friends or family in battleground states, be sure to reach out to them and let them know that they have to vote in person. And there's a lot of confusion because of COVID. So many polling places have been shut down over the years, and a lot of cities are having a hard time or have had a hard time finding poll workers. So they had to shut down precincts. You can find out where to vote by going to voteamerica.com. And if you need help, you can text their helpline 48298. It's voteamerica.com, or you can text 48298. And if you're in San Francisco and you cannot get to a polling place, if you're an elder, you have a disability, you just can't get there on your own, the Shanti Project is hooking up volunteers with people, and they will deliver your ballot, and they will also let you know how to track your ballot. It's Shanti, Shanti.org. And I'll repeat this throughout the next half hour. David, one of the things I'm very concerned about is organizations are doing a great word of getting the word out. Vote in person or drop off your ballot. I'm really concerned that we're going to have really long lines on election night and Republicans will file lawsuits to shut down the polls. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a reasonable fear to have. I think what we have seen is that Republicans do not intend to let this vote go on a second after, you know, 7 or 8 o'clock in as many states as possible. And they understand that in-person voting is likely to favor Republicans. It's that a red mirage that the political scientists talk about. Republican votes are often counted first, and early returns are going to show Republicans in the lead in many of these states. So the nightmare scenario that so many people have is that Republicans find themselves in court on election night or the night after, attempting to stop the count and say, we are ahead on election night, and all of these mail and absentee ballots that are yet to be counted are somehow fraudulent. And the disturbing news from the Supreme Court this week is that at least 3 or 4 of the conservatives on the court are open to this argument, have been advancing this argument. We don't know where Justice Amy Coney Barrett comes down on this yet. She was not willing to talk about it during her confirmation hearings, and she has stepped aside from these first rulings because she says she has not had time to catch up on all of the briefs and filings. But she notably said she would not recuse herself. And, you know, I think it is very disturbing that in so many ways, the fate of American democracy rests on this fifth conservative justice, all of them to the right of the man who authored the Shelby County decision, the chief justice, who President Trump has very clearly said was put on the court in order to rule in precisely this kind of scenario.
What really strikes you about the lawyers that have been are getting ready for election night, the Republican lawyers and the lawyers on the Democratic side? How do you see things playing out?
It's a really good question. You know, I think that the Democrats are certainly ready for this. Mark Elias and all of these Democratic trial lawyers who have been, you know, so active over the course of this year and in many ways very successful in lower courts are certainly ready for this. The question is, I think, less about the lawyers than it is about how Barrett is willing to rule on these cases and whether the U.S. Supreme Court is really willing to intrude on state Supreme Court's readings of their own state constitutions. This has been a firewall that the court has not been willing to go there. And in these cases, what you are saying is that the U.S. Supreme Court is really positioning itself as almost this super federal electoral board that is willing to reach into North Carolina, willing to reach into Wisconsin, into Pennsylvania, and say, no, the state Supreme Court cannot interpret state law. We're going to do that for you. And if that's the case, it is deeply disturbing, not only for what the kind of legislation or the kind of litigation we are likely to see in the days after this election, but it bodes poorly for voting rights in general, because a lot of the fight against gerrymandering, against voter suppression, has really been led by state Supreme Courts. The new maps in Pennsylvania, in North Carolina, the fight against gerrymandering in many states has been based in many ways on the fact that state constitutions offer greater protection for voting rights and free and fair elections than the U.S. Constitution does. If the Supreme Court is willing to step in even there, it feels dark.
We're speaking with David Daley, an independent journalist and author of Unrigged, How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. If you have any questions for David about what might play out on election night, what people can actually do to secure the vote, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have a question from Leslie, who writes, what authority do Republicans have to file suits to stop ballot counting? Would this only be able to happen in states that have Republican-dominated legislatures? This would not gain any traction in California, for instance.
No, I don't think it would gain any traction in California. I think the fear is that this is going to be focused in the states where it's going to be very close. And so it's not any coincidence that we're talking about Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, North Carolina, Minnesota, states that are expected to be super tight on Tuesday. And what I think is so problematic about this is Pennsylvania and Wisconsin could solve this problem really, really easily if the state legislatures there would simply allow for these absentee ballots to be counted and processed earlier. In his decision in the Wisconsin case on Monday, Justice Kavanaugh wrote that these states simply want to avoid the chaos of having an outcome flip after Election Day and the suspicions of impropriety that would ensue. And he said the states also want to be able to definitively announce the results of the election on election night or as soon as possible thereafter. He's kind of echoing points that President Trump has made in his Twitter feed. The trouble is, it's not that a result might potentially flip after election night. There is no result to flip if all of the votes have not been counted. And these states, if they really wanted to definitively announce the results of the election, Wisconsin and Pennsylvania could have changed their laws over at any point in time since the pandemic struck in March and since it became clear that millions of mail-in ballots were going to have to be processed and counted. And they could allow their nonpartisan election officials to start counting and preparing and opening and doing the signature checks before Election Day. 40 other states allow this. The gerrymandered legislatures, these Republican legislatures, have refused to do this over the course of the year. So they have set the conditions for this kind of constitutional crisis. This is not just happening at the Supreme Court. These rulings are really dangerous. But I think we have to keep in mind that this is a full-on project. These cases would not be possible or necessary if these states would join the rest of the nation and begin processing ballots early.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the historical context you include in your piece that explains really how we got here. Let's talk first about gerrymandering. You write that today more than 50 million Americans, nearly one in five of us, live in a state in which one or both chambers of the legislature are controlled by the party that won fewer votes. And yes, all of those people live in states where Democrats won more votes, but Republicans hold the power. You were on our show years ago, David, talking about the red map strategy. And, you know, Karl Rove was behind this. He wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about this. It was led by former RNC Ed Gillespie. It was funded with $30 million by companies like Walmart, AT&T, Citigroup, the U.S. Chamber of Congress, and Blue Cross Blue Shield. And so talk just a minute about, because we have you on for about 15 more minutes, and I want to make sure we get to as much as we can in your piece. Red Map really made a huge difference in the 2010 election.
We live in Red Map Nation, and I don't think you can understand our politics for the last decade without grappling with what Republicans did that year. We redraw every legislative district, every state legislative and congressional district every 10 years after the census. And what Republicans set out to do in 2010 was to win every seat at the table in redistricting. In Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and North Carolina and Florida and Michigan and Ohio and Texas. And they were successful at this, and they had complete control over drawing the maps. And those maps have endured this entire decade. As you mentioned, you know, more than 50 million of us living in states in which Democrats win more votes and yet Republicans hold all of the power, including all of those swing states. They've been able to enact deeply regressive voting rights policies in all of those states. And indeed, it's those gerrymandered legislatures in those states that could have done something about opening ballots early. And if it all goes wrong, if the worst nightmare scenarios come true, it's going to be these gerrymandered legislatures, these Republican bodies that have enacted enduring minority rule in these states, that in the worst nightmare scenarios posited by election law experts, these are the people who could be trying to override the popular vote and choose electoral college electors. And that is, you know, the checkmate of this Republican strategy for minority rule.
And you interviewed the Reverend Dr. William Barber, who said, quote, they cracked, stacked, packed, and bleached black voters.
Oh, they absolutely did. I mean, Red Map really resegregated much of the South, but also much of, what you do when you gerrymander is you try and draw as many of the other side's voters into as few districts as possible. So if you look at the seats around Detroit, for example, or around Philadelphia, around Cleveland, what Republicans did was draw the wildest seats that they could that collect as many black voters, as many Democratic voters, and they crammed them into districts that elect a Democrat with 80-85% of the vote, and then that in turn makes the rest of the state more Republican, because anytime you put, you know, voters in one district, it affects all of the others. So that was how, under the old map in Pennsylvania, for example, Democrats could win more votes, but Republicans could hold 13 of the 18 seats, or how Ohio could be a 50-50 state, but Republicans would hold 12 of the 16 seats.
You write that former Attorney General Eric Holder and then President Obama really didn't see Red Map coming. After Obama's 2012 reelection, Attorney General Holder told you that he and Obama spent a very confused evening at the White House looking over the results and trying to understand why the Republicans still had held the House and had so much power in state capitals.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, Obama and Holder had a lot of other things to be doing over those years. So, you know, I don't think this is their fault necessarily, but I think the Democratic Party fell asleep on the importance of redistricting in 2010. And then the kind of technology that was used to the kind of sophisticated computer mapping software, the big data that became available, the Republicans who drew these maps in 2011 were able to make them more enduring than any other gerrymander in our history. And 2012, they proved to be the Republican firewall. And, you know, Democrats won 1.4 million more votes for the U.S. House that year, but Republicans hold a 33-seat majority. And it was the first year that it became clear that, you know, Democrats had a big problem out in the states, and they have not managed to flip back a single one of those chambers this entire decade under these maps.
You also write that the Republicans were really surprised also by the party's failure to win the presidency, because here they are having all of this new power, and yet they did not win the White House. And you write about this report called the Growth and Opportunity Project. It was basically a diagnosis about where the party, the Republican Party, was at the time and where it was going. The report said it's just a party of stuffy old men. It's talking to itself. If it really wants to increase its base, it needs to embrace comprehensive immigration reform because the country is changing. But as you write, the autopsy was dead on arrival.
I think that's right. I think the Republicans had two paths ahead of them after the 2008 election. They could have looked at the changing demographics of the nation and decided they wanted to speak to every voter in a vibrant, multiracial democracy. Instead, they decided to run Red Map. Instead, they decided to gerrymander. And when you gerrymander, you lock in control for your party. But they also changed the nature of who could be elected from these districts, because when you create so many non-competitive Republican districts, the election that suddenly matters is the party primary. And that is a low turnout base election. The most extreme voters show up in those races, and the most extreme candidates usually win. And what these strategists failed to recognize is that they would have control, but they were creating a Frankenstein's monster that would turn around and devour them in turn. My favorite example of this is Mark Meadows, and maybe I've talked about this on the show in the past. I mean, Mark Meadows runs for and wins one of these new North Carolina districts that Republicans draw after they take control of the legislature, and they take a Democratic seat that had been a swing seat for a decade. They crack the city of Asheville in half. They create two conservative districts. They lock themselves in a 10-3 majority. But it's not just any old 10-3. It's that Mark Meadows runs for this seat. He runs as a birther. You can go out and find on YouTube the video of Meadows talking about sending Barack Obama back to Kenya or wherever it is he comes from. Meadows wins a multi-candidate primary with about 38% of the vote, and then he is able to cruise into office in this one-party seat. So while Republicans gave themselves control of the House, they also put all of these people like Meadows, like the Freedom Caucus, in charge of the party. And they made it so that in 2012, when they realized, oh, well, maybe we ought to talk to more voters. Maybe people see us as stuffy as old men. Maybe immigrants think we don't even want them in the country. They were not able to change because they had put in charge that segment of the party. And that was that.
And now we're probably going to have a QAnon, I don't even know what to call them, believer, QAnon follower, who's going to Congress.
From one of these districts in Georgia that was drawn to elect the craziest member. Well, they found her.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, that's her name. And she's 43, and she's from a wealthy suburb in Atlanta, and she's probably going to Congress, right?
Before Red Map, before Republicans had the power to completely redraw all of these districts in Georgia, there were a handful of very competitive seats that flipped back and forth throughout the 2000s, or that were regularly within 2 or 3%. When Republicans remapped the state, they locked themselves into such power that it set the conditions for a QAnon member of Congress. It set the conditions at the state house level. More than 80% of all state legislative districts in 2016 had no competition from the other major party candidate. It destroyed electoral competition in the state of Georgia, and it made it possible for the election and the enactment of all kinds of voter suppression laws in Georgia, all kinds of voter purges, all kinds of precinct closures that contributed to the victory of Governor Kemp in 2018 over Stacey Abrams in that close race. In these super close races in all of these states, these kinds of voter suppression techniques really matter. It was only 40,000 votes in Georgia, right? So when you close hundreds of precincts across the state, when you require a specific form of ID, when you gerrymander so many races that people feel their votes don't matter or count, when you purge names off the rolls, all of that knocks off a certain number of people. It makes the bar just a little bit higher. It means the lines are a little bit longer. It means all of these things that have to be overcome if you want your vote to count. And I worry that that's exactly what we are seeing in states like Wisconsin, like North Carolina, like Pennsylvania, right? In which when you know a race is going to be close, you do everything you can to try to knock off as many of the Democratic-leaning votes as you can. We're seeing it in Texas. We're seeing it in Minnesota. This is the strategy, and we have to have our eyes on it.
Based on all of the reporting that you've done, when you look at the Freedom Caucus, this now potential QAnon congresswoman, do you think that the party can move even further to the right?
I do. And I think what we have to remember is that this strategy predated Donald Trump, and it will continue after Donald Trump. Donald Trump did not orchestrate Red Map. That was the former chairman of the Republican National Committee. You know, Karl Rove is involved with this. Donald Trump did not draw these lines after 2010. Donald Trump was not on the Supreme Court that gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013 in Shelby County versus Holder and eliminated preclearance. Trump simply came along and swept up the pieces of what this Republican project and strategy created. And all of that is still going to be in effect, even if Trump loses, even if there is a peaceful transition of power. The courts have been packed with conservatives who are deeply opposed, evidently, to the expansion of voting rights and making it easier for people to vote rather than harder. The state legislatures remain packed. And the Republican Party, the power base, has moved from people like Ed Gillespie and Karl Rove. I think it has slid consistently to those who would make it harder to vote. The strategy in state after state, in all of these legislatures and all of these court battles, is between a party that is trying to make it easier for all Americans to vote and a party that is consistently trying to make it harder. You can remove Donald Trump from this equation, and the basic formula still remains.
We have a question from Mark, who says, like David, I'm pleased that some prominent Republicans are against Trump and some even decry voter suppression, but I'm disturbed by how few seem to acknowledge their responsibility, how they set the table for Trump, how they collaborated in such anti-democratic efforts for decades. In your conversations, were any of them owning up to their past and now willing to sacrifice power for democracy?
I share that frustration, and you know, I did find that, you know, Michael Steele, Bill Kristol, Bob Inglis, that they were absolutely willing to own up to this and that they are committed to voting rights if they take power back at some point down the road. But I attempted to talk to all of these Republicans who I've been talking about. You know, I mean, I tried to get Eric Cantor and Paul Ryan and John Boehner and all of these folks who were involved in these efforts to talk to me, and they all refused. Boehner and Ryan are deeply involved in Republican efforts to gerrymander, in efforts to run a 2020 project called Right Lines, which is a project of the Republican State Leadership Committee that ran Red Map. I don't think that enough Republicans in prominent positions recognize that it's their own actions that brought us to this place, and that the place that they have led to is very dark for voting rights and majority rule in a representative democracy.
Final thoughts, David. What else can people do to counter all this? I mean, the country is changing. It's far more diverse. So many young people are getting involved. I've heard interview after interview with young people who said, I didn't vote in 2016, but I am voting in 2020. And so many people running for office. That has also been amazing to see, and they're winning.
It's so wonderful to see, and I think we should all be so inspired by groups like Run for Something and Sister District, groups that have been encouraging people to win and helping Democrats build power at the state legislative and the local level, and really understanding that the path to enduring power has to be from the ground up. And I think that's what Republicans have understood for a long time. And it's what was behind this effort in 2010 to sort of, you know, take back state legislatures, knowing that state legislatures play this outsized role in redistricting. Well, 2020, it's another redistricting year. So if there's something you can do, you can vote up and down your ballot, because the White House, super important, control of the Senate, super important. But it's these state legislative races on the ballot this year that are going to decide who gets to draw these lines for the next decade. Donald Trump, Joe Biden, whoever is in the White House in 2020, there will be another election in 2024, or so we think, right? The lines that are drawn next year in these state houses and for Congress are going to be with us until 2031.
So important. David, we will definitely have you on after the election to talk more about this. Thank you so much for your great work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Always a pleasure.
David Daley is an independent journalist, senior fellow for Fair Vote, and author of Unrigged: How Americans Are Battling Back to Save Democracy. I hope you can take some time over the weekend to read his very important piece, Inside the Republican Plot for Permanent Minority Rule. He wrote it for The New Republic, and it's on our website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will speak with Alfredo Corchado about massive voter turnout in Texas, and we'll also find out why COVID is surging in El Paso. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about two important issues happening in Texas. Massive, massive voter turnout. And unfortunately, a COVID surge. First, we'll talk about COVID. Rural hospitals are struggling to keep up in places like Amarillo, Lubbock, and El Paso. Today's guest, Alfredo Corchado, reports that an El Paso County judge called for a shutdown of all non-essential businesses for 2 weeks as record-setting numbers of COVID cases overwhelm hospitals. The order sets up a possible confrontation with Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who has issued a statewide executive order allowing some non-essential businesses to reopen at 75% of capacity. El Paso has reached 100% of hospital capacity because of COVID. Alfredo Corchado is Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, where he covers U.S. policy in Latin America. His most recent book is Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and a Fate of Great Mexican-American Migration. Hi, Alfredo. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Well, it's great to be with you. And I'm actually here in El Paso today.
Oh, you are in El Paso. We're so sorry to hear what is happening with the COVID spike. What explains what's going on in El Paso? Why are 100% of hospitals at capacity?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, the president keeps talking about rounding the corner in El Paso and the region. It feels like we're diving off a cliff here. There's been a lot of finger pointing. The county judge has said, you know, perhaps Governor Abbott reopened too soon. People dropped their guards. The mayor of El Paso says it's just, you know, plain COVID fatigue. People are just kind of giving up. And I mean, just hours after the county judge issued this new order, you have the community has kind of responded, you know, divided between, yes, let's do what the county judge is saying. A lot of businesses, a lot of gyms, hair salons, massage salons have come out with this hashtag keep 915 open, which is the El Paso area code. So this is not over by any means. I mean, I think it's going to become very contagious. But, you know, the sad problem is that the hospital capacity has just been overwhelmed. I mean, it's nearly 400% increase in the last 2-3 weeks. The deaths are beginning to pile up. Today, for the first time, they more than 10 people die. I mean, every day it's been two or three. It's been the biggest spike that we've seen in a while. And the real challenge is El Paso is right on the border with Ciudad Juarez and, of course, Las Cruces, New Mexico. So it's It's a tri-state bi-national community, and trying to, get a handle on the coronavirus is very, very challenging for two governments.
Right, because you write, as you said, both places are seeing a surge and hospitals on both sides of the border are on the brink.
Right. I mean, Juarez, just yesterday, I mean, they've set up new makeshift beds. The focus is on El Paso, but I would say Ciudad Juarez is in a much worse situation. Hmm. They don't really have much help from the federal government. The state government is trying to do everything it can. The mayor of the city is in the hospital fighting COVID for the second time. First time was in May. He's been there for at least a week now, and he's on a respirator. It's a real dire situation. And then the challenge is you have about 100,000 Americans who live in Ciudad Juarez, either permanent residents or U.S. citizens. These are people who cross back and forth for essential reasons, either work or school. Although school has been shut down, I mean, people are mostly doing virtual. But the challenge of trying to stop people from going back and forth and infecting one another, El Paso has been quick to say, a lot of the COVID cases are coming because people are going into Ciudad Juarez. The mayor, even from the hospital, has called for the ban of Americans into coming to Ciudad Juarez. He doesn't want to see Americans at this stage. The foreign minister of Mexico just issued a statement just minutes ago saying, we will not stop the flow of Americans. The impact on the economy would be too great.
In your piece about what's happening in Juarez, Alfredo, you write that authorities are imposing brief prison time for those not wearing face masks.
Right. I mean, it's about 24-hour prison time. They're imposing fines for people driving more than two to a car. I mean, last weekend, I think they reported more than 100 family gatherings and parties. Mm-hmm. So you see the fatigue it also sets in on the Mexican side. And it's coming up to the holiday season and you have multi-generational families on both sides. That's the common household. So I think the judge is, I talked to him the other day, and I think he's really hoping that in the end, I think when the death numbers start spiking up, that maybe then people will take this a lot more seriously on both sides.
Alfredo, how are people just getting by in El Paso and Juarez? I mean, here in the States, there's going to be no relief bill until we don't even know when. I mean, people are really struggling to make ends meet. What are you hearing from people in El Paso? How are they doing?
Well, I mean, it's not different than the U.S. I mean, evictions, you drive around some of the main streets in El Paso, the for lease signs keep going up. When the announcement came in last night, there were a lot of businesses who said, this is it. I mean, we can't survive another shutdown, even if it's for 2 weeks. Especially businesses right along the U.S.-Mexico border that depend so much on shoppers from the other side, whether it's Americans going to Juarez or Mexicans coming to the U.S. I mean, this is it. It's a Thanksgiving, Christmas holiday. If you don't make money, then you're out, and you're seeing that last gasp. People losing their jobs, people who can't pay the rent. You see that more and more. But the Mexicans will point to the U.S. and say, at least they got some help. Maybe they're not getting help anymore from Congress, but at least for a while they had some help. Mexicans have been fending off on their own. One of the things that you see the numbers in Mexico, it's more than 11,000 people have died, but the testing number is, I mean, they're so low because they lag so much. And to get a test in Ciudad Juarez, you have to pay about $250.
Wow.
And that's been really hard for a lot of people. Some U.S. foreign companies are stepping in and trying to make sure that the workforce continues But even then, I mean, there are a lot of factories in Juarez who are reporting large workforces who are not just not showing up to work. So that's kind of also impact the supply chain for the United States. Some of these companies are auto plants or medical facilities. So that at some point will impact the U.S. consumer.
I've also been thinking a lot about undocumented immigrants because, I mean, in a state like California, they only had access to a $500 check. And as you can imagine, once the availability came open, I mean, they were gone immediately. So undocumented immigrants, still have not received any assistance. And when you look at the restaurants that are opening, places that are opening, it's mostly Latinos who are doing this work and then taking many cases, taking COVID back home with them.
Well, that's a huge issue. I mean, Latinos, as we all know, I mean, they're in the front line. I mean, they're the essential workers. And they don't, you know, we talk about fatigue and so forth, but also a lot of people don't really have a choice. I mean, they have to work. They don't have any money to pay their rent. Or it's the same situation in Juarez. I know of a lot of women in Ciudad Juarez and men who are gardeners or women who come here and take care of the elderly, take care of homes. I mean, they're out looking, they're in the streets looking for jobs, you know, to try to do anything because, again, Mexicans are banned from crossing into the United States since March. Americans can go back and forth for essential reasons, but Mexicans as a whole have been banned from coming into the United States. So the degree of desperation is much higher on the Mexican side.
Wow, that must be so hard also for families that are separated. I mean, so many of us have been separated from our families for months, but at least we can see them outside.
On the U.S. side, you know, trying to help those on the Mexican side. I mean, you see a lot of that going on. El Pasoans who cross into Mexico and wait for someone and, you know, give a donation. That's been going on, you know, more on a personal basis because we all know someone who's going through a hard time on the Mexican side.
Before we get to voting, Alfredo, what are your thoughts about how Texas politicians are going to deal with this COVID surge? Carlos Sanchez, who, let me grab his title here. He is head of public affairs for Hidalgo County. He wrote a piece in The Atlantic called "COVID is Killing My People and No One Seems to Care."
Carlos Sanchez is a great journalist. Spent a lot of time in El Paso, so I know him well. We worked together at the El Paso Herald Post many moons ago. But he's absolutely right. I mean, the big challenge is Hidalgo County, the Rio Grande Valley, went through a terrible, terrible time just a few weeks ago. And so El Paso has been trying to learn the lessons from the Hidalgo County and the entire Rio Grande Valley. And one thing we've learned is that the governor basically did not heed the calls to shut down the economy. I mean, they had to do it on their own. Mm-hmm. I think El Paso is looking at the same situation. But, I mean, we are days away from an election. And I think this thing is just becoming so politicized. The mayor of El Paso is Republican. The county judge is Democrat. And so you see this political spat, unfortunately, right in the middle, right, you know, 4 or 5 days before the election. And the county judge said yesterday, you know, yeah, I could have waited a few more days, but the numbers just keep increasing so much. El Paso is in a critical phase. We could be looking at hundreds of people dying before the election. So it's been a tough call for him, and he's getting a lot of heat for it. But we'll see Tuesday. I mean, and you're right. I mean, he made it very clear last night. We are shutting down the city and dining, massage parlors and so forth. But he urged people to continue voting, get out and vote. We'll see what that impact that is.
To that point, Alfredo, we only have about a minute left, but Kamala Harris is in Texas today, and hopefully she'll mention what's going on in South Texas with this COVID surge and maybe call out some of these politicians. who are not taking action. But it's a pretty big deal that Kamala Harris is in Texas just days before the election, and we've seen massive voter turnout in the state.
Yeah, the Castro brothers are also in South Texas with Senator Harris. Beto O'Rourke is down there. They're trying to drive up and voter enthusiasm, voter turnout. I mean, it's going to come down to that in the Valley. We look at the numbers in Texas, something like more than 9 million people have already voted in the entire state of Texas. It surpassed the entire 2016 voter turnout. But they have to look at some of these pockets like the Valley and make sure that people do turn out to vote. We're looking at, for someone who's been covering politics for a long time, I mean, it's a very exciting time to be in Texas.
I can imagine. Well, Alfredo, we'll be thinking of you and your family and everyone in South Texas. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Alfredo Corchado is Mexico Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, and he's author of Homelands, Four Friends, Two Countries, and the Fate of the Great Mexican-American Migration. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running. And once again, be sure to vote in person or drop off your ballot at an official voting station. And you can find where to vote by visiting voteamerica.com. That is voteamerica.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.